sure hope you're hungry. Ooh, I'm starving. Wash those hands, pull up a chair, and secure that feed bag. Because it's time to listen to Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss attempt to use human language to converse with and pick the brains of other developers. I thought there was going to be food. So buckle up and grab that O-shit handle, because this ride is going to get wild. This is the Syntax Supper Club.
Welcome to Syntax. In today's Supper Club, we have a really good one. Besides being a member of the world-famous Robotops B-Boy crew, we have Eric Sartorius, who has traveled the world as a developer. He mentors new devs, all while working full-time and freelancing. Not only that, but his code is also all over the Level Up Tutorials code bases. He's been helping me work on this thing for a long time. Welcome to the show, Eric Sartorius. Eric, what's up, man?
What's going on? Yeah, hopefully the code that's all over your code base is good code, not bad. But
yeah, I mean, you would be surprised at how many times I look at the Git blame and it's Scott Tolinsky is to blame. So there's not too many times where I'm like, what's going on here? For those of you don't, you know, have never heard of Eric, I've known Eric, I don't know, for like since like 2006, maybe a very long time. We've been a part of the same dance crew forever. We've entered competitions all over and we've been coding together. So Eric, do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, who you are, what you do for your job currently, and, you know, a little bit about your journey into development?
So yeah, right now I own a agency, as you said, web development agency, called Pure Funk. That's with a C, not a K, keeping it funky. But yeah, I've been coding for like, 9 years now. And at the beginning of my journey, I basically started because I wanted to travel. And then it got me into like digital nomading and traveling all over for like years. I almost feel like I'm fresh off the boat now, like back in the States. I haven't been here for like so long. I think I was gone 15 years total. But right now I just keep coding and traveling, and like, it's just what I do, who I am.
Yeah. For as long as I've known you, you have been somewhere, whether it's you teaching in Japan for a couple of years or, I don't know, quite a while, actually. You were almost never around. And then when you were around, we'd get to enter some battles together here or there or whatever. So where have you traveled? Can you list like all of the places you traveled, or is there too many?
I mean, it might be quicker to list where I haven't traveled. But let me see here. So I've probably been close to around 40 countries.
Wow.
Only continent that I haven't hit so far is Antarctica, but hoping to put that on the map as well. So yeah, I've been around.
That's awesome.
Antarctica, is that something that you would actually do?
Oh yeah, for sure. So I actually, there's the highest mountain in Antarctica right now is Mount Vinson. And I really want to climb it after, we can get into this later, but I climbed Kilimanjaro recently and I need another like big one to hit, you know? The only problem is like, I looked up the cost to do that with the flights over there and like the tours and everything. It's like close to 50K we're looking at US dollars. So
I
might have to get a GoFundMe started or something to do that. Get some sponsors.
That's incredible, man. We can talk about the Kilimanjaro thing in a bit, because I want to like get into like even some of your mindset for some of that stuff. But I don't even know you. I mean, I talk to you all the time and I didn't even know you were doing that until you're like, yeah, I'm heading to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. I was just like, wait, what? What are you doing? Because you're not like even a mountain climber. I mean, I guess you are now a mountain climber, considering you've climbed that. But was that...
Climbed a mountain.
Okay, well, yeah, let's talk about Kilimanjaro in a bit. We can talk about your history with mountains and stuff. Okay, so you travel a lot. You've traveled for both work and just for fun. I guess one of the things that I'd really like to get out of you in this conversation is like really understanding some of the tips that you might have for people in terms of like being able to travel while having a job. So I guess first and foremost, have you found it to be challenging at all working across time zones and maybe even cross body Wi-Fi connections while managing to work?
Oh, definitely. There's always challenges. So like right now, I should say one of the companies I'm working for called Stream, they're based out of Amsterdam and they have employees all over the world right now. The main chunk of people that I work with right now is either in Brazil or US, but there's also some employees that I have meetings with over in Amsterdam and Europe, Portugal. I think one of the main things that you just have to keep in mind when working in different time zones is that you have to be flexible, right? Like there are some times where I'm working late at night. I have a lot of, you know, 7, 6 a.m. meetings. You know, even outside of what I'm doing now, I've had meetings in the past with clients where I've, you know, I've been in Mauritius and it's 4 a.m. and I have a daily stand-up every day. It's just kind of some of the trade-offs with being able to travel, you know, like if I look at it some other way, you know, I think I'd rather get up early or stay up late here and there just to, you know, communicate now and then with people as opposed to always be in the same time zone and never be able to leave my house.
So. Yeah, that's wild. So like where are you working? Because I always think about this a lot is that even when I'm like traveling, I feel like I'm not as productive. And like, do you get a desk in every city that you're working? You go to co-working? Do you have like a daily routine? Or are you simply just like slinging your laptop and sitting on a rock and banging out some code and then like grabbing your big bag? That's kind of what I sometimes think about digital nomads. They have these huge backpacks and then you can't hear from them in 2 weeks. And then before you know it, you're on a Zoom call in the back of a coal train across Saudi Arabia or something like that.
I have yet to do that one. I'm going to have to try that. A coal train across Saudi Arabia.
Hold on. Have you seen the, I think it's Shai. There's a YouTuber that like does like, he goes into trains and stuff like that. And he crosses all these crazy train hopping videos. It's a wild watch if you ever get into that.
I have not heard of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't tried that one yet.
So yeah. So where do you work? Do you pop into coffee shops or what's your main strategy? If you're like, I need to be productive today, what do you do?
So it depends on the country really. One good example is like Korea. I was there, I lived there for 6 years. But then on and off outside of that, like I should back up and start saying before I even did the digital nomad thing and before I did coding, I got my first glimpse into living overseas as an English teacher. I was there 5 years in Japan teaching English and then the same amount of time over in Korea teaching English. But
weren't you briefly a male model as well in Japan?
Oh, dude, I did everything. Yeah, I did some modeling, did some product modeling, some runway shows. Yeah, dude.
Oh my God.
The stuff you can get into over there is pretty fun. But so, yeah, it depends on country. Korea, like I was saying, the Wi-Fi is like everywhere there. It's phenomenal, 100% coverage. And like every cafe is open like 24 hours and has great Wi-Fi. And there's just so many cafes. It's a huge cafe culture. So what I would end up doing there is every day I would rotate a different cafe. And I just think of it as like the price of a coffee or two, depending, you know, how long I stay, is it much cheaper than if I was paying for, you know, a private office or something like that. Mm. But then again, it also depends on your budget, right? Like when I first started coding and did the traveling around, I was on a shoestring budget, had like no money. I was staying at people's houses and working from their kitchen tables most of the time. So like that's another one, working at kitchen tables, making sure, you know, if I'm at an Airbnb that they have a desk or some resemblance of it. But then there's other countries like, so this might be surprising, but Japan, when I was over there working, a lot of times their cafes don't have Wi-Fi. And I found it difficult to work there. And so I'd have to work from like home a lot more than Korea, for example.
So where do you go to research this type of thing? How are you going to find out? Are you the type that just goes and figures it out? Or do you have like places that you research and look into finding what are the best locations to live and work from in these areas?
So the way I research and work at places now, I'll have to say, is different than before pre-pandemic. So pre-pandemic, I was basically for a 4-year stint, just lived out of a suitcase, right? So that everything I owned was in that suitcase. If I wanted to buy a new t-shirt, I'd have to pick something in the suitcase to throw out because I was at the limit, right? So at that time, every 3 months was usually like the limit for a holiday visa for American in most countries I went to. So every 3 months I had to start planning, where am I going next at the same time as like, what am I doing now? And a lot of times it was based on my current location because I would get a lot of one-way flights. And if I just found a cheap ticket somewhere that I had never been, I just booked that first and then started thinking about like accommodations and Wi-Fi and all that later. Whereas now I have a base now. I've bought a house during the pandemic because there's just nothing else to do. Now every other month I'm flying out somewhere, but my trips are only like a month long, and I put more planning effort into like if there's an actual place to work or not, because I have a little bit more budget now compared to, you know, when I first started out too.
Dude, I remember like one time you were like, yeah, I'm going to Medellin, Colombia for a little bit. I was like, okay. And then you're like, yeah, I'm going to go to Germany for a little bit. Oh, okay. Like when I first found out you were like just bouncing all around, it was like really pretty wild to me. And then as I got, you know, to work with you longer and longer, it was just like, okay, it doesn't even matter where he is today. I have no idea where he is today. It doesn't matter because we'll connect at some point on asynchronous chat or whatever if we have anything to share. But yeah, it's always really shocking to me that you were able to like get to these places and be able to be still so productive.
I was just going to say, yeah, it's not for everyone. You have to be able to make yourself productive. And a lot of people, they have routines based on their environment. Like they'll wake up every morning, go down, you know, get a cup of coffee, whatever. I had to make routines that were based on solely myself or my mental state, right? So no matter what country I'm in, no matter what hotel I'm in or wherever, I would do the exact same like morning mobility stretch routine. And like, it just gets me in the mindset to start work. And I don't have that commute to reset me. But having that as like a core of stabilization definitely helps in working from anywhere in any time zone.
That's awesome. So, did you say this already? Where are you right now?
Right now I'm in Phoenix, Arizona.
Oh, very exotic. Wow.
Yeah, at one point he was living in Denver here with us. And then when he moved out, I got a couple of new pieces of exercise gear from Eric's apartment that he couldn't take with him on his next adventure.
Yeah, like Scott said, I was in Denver for 6 months while I was still part of my huge world tour. And I just buy enough in a studio apartment to like be able to sell and last me. So when I lived there, I just had one mattress, one pull-up bar, one kettlebell, and some puzzle mats on the floor. And I basically rebuy that stuff every time I live somewhere longer than 3 months because it's the same things that I use every single time.
I use that kettlebell still all the time. Use it all the time. I think about it. Hey, it's getting a lot of use still. When you apply for a job and you're like talking to an interviewer and maybe let's say a position's remote, right? Or at least you're advocating for remote work in it. Is this something that you tell them that like, hey, I'm going to be traveling or I would like to travel all around, but I'm still productive. I've been doing this for X amount of time. Or is this something that you like wait until you're hired and then try to negotiate that way?
So yeah, there's a lot of like Reddit threads and stuff around this particular subject. It's pretty interesting. If you think about it this way, at least from a, you know, US citizen point of view, if I was to apply for a new full-time job and get one, mostly because of like tax and stuff like that, insurance and whatnot, they don't want you to work anywhere other than the current state you're in or the current country you're in. You might be able to get away with traveling to other countries and working for, you know, a week or two here and there, but if you're too long in another place, they don't usually let you do it. So there's some people that'll just pretend like they're working in one place, put their background in as one of those, you know, Zoom backgrounds.
Yeah.
It's all blurred out and they'll just work from different people and try and get away from it or get away with it. But they sometimes get caught and fired and whatnot. But for me personally, I usually, when I look for work, is contracts that are done through my company, Pure Funk. And so then my company decides, you know, where I can and can't work from, and the money's all coming into the same place. So it's a little bit different that way when you're working with contract work. Yeah. So when I was traveling full time, it was all contract work.
Isn't that like expensive to always be out on the road, or is that just like your methodology in life is like, I just need a kettlebell and a puzzle mat and I need to be on the open road?
Yeah. So I feel like there's different levels to digital nomading that a lot of people don't understand. There's different ways to do it, right? One of the unfortunate things with like the boom and things like Instagram and things like that is you only really see like really high quality, you know, if you follow a digital nomad person, really high quality images and things of them like working in some glorious location, you know, like on top of a mountain. And like, in all honesty, I used to kind of fall into that a little bit before. I don't anymore as much, but I would like just lug a computer to the top of a mountain and take a selfie to make it look like I worked there. But there is no Wi-Fi. There's a glare on the screen. I can't see a damn thing. So yeah, like it isn't what it seems to some expect, but yeah, it depends on what kind of digital nomad you are though, right? Like if you're making a ton of money, you're just going to go around and work in different, you know, working spaces. And you're going to have a high budget. You're going to take, you know, maybe business class planes, whatever. But when I first started out, I think my first contract was like $25 an hour. I went overseas and started working. And then after 2 months, the contract got canceled and I was forced to basically spend no money until I got my next contract, which ended up being a year later, which is pretty crazy. I started digging into savings. But that year, I meticulously counted like every penny I spent. And it was about $10,000 for the span of 1 year that I spent. And I still went to like probably 10 different countries. So
That's crazy efficient. So efficient. What's the most expensive thing typically when traveling? Like if there's one thing that costs more besides like the cost of travel itself, like what is the one thing in your day-to-day that ends up being the thing you got to worry about the most?
It really depends on country. Because over in like Southeast Asia, for example, food is so cheap. You can eat for like $5 a day, right? So food doesn't become a problem there. You can, same with like, you know, hospital bills, whatever, you get hurt, it's pretty cheap. But you get over to like the US or Europe, that can be a bit more expensive. So you have to start changing the way you eat. You have to start making food instead of just buying out, right? Transportation usually is my biggest cost, I think, overall, but or actually accommodation these days, things have shifted a lot. Because I can find some pretty cheap flights and use like credit card points to book them and stuff. But yeah, now like, so when I first started doing the digital nomad thing, Airbnbs were super cheap if you got them for a month, right? I got 40% discounts sometimes. Like I'll go back to, I was talking about Mauritius before, which for those of you who don't know, it's a little island between the coast of like Madagascar and Maldives around that area.
I've never heard of that before.
yeah, it's like Africa's Hawaii in a way.
Oh
but
my gosh.
Really,
yeah, wow. It seems amazing.
Super dope country. Yeah, beautiful beaches there. Oh, you've been there too, Wes?
No, I was contacted by, I have like coupon codes to different countries around the world. And when I rolled that out, I was contacted by several people that lived in Mauritius. And I was just like, I've never heard of Mauritius. So
yeah,
it seems awesome. I'd love to visit someday.
Bluest water ever. But yeah, I was able to snag an Airbnb deal there that was, if I stayed for a month, I get 40% off. And that ended up being $400 for the month. I got my own room. Breakfast was included. Had a pool. And it was a 5-minute walk from the beach. And it was just like,
oh my gosh,
you know. Yeah, it was ridiculous. But then, you know, there's other countries like you're in Europe and if to get anywhere, you got to take a train and it gets super expensive, you know, and it really depends on where you're at and what deals you can get. So yeah, it's like I seek more comfort now because I can, but I was seeking lower prices before because I could. One other thing that was super helpful when I was trying to go on a shoestring budget was my B-boy connection. And Scott knows about this, but like breakdancers are some of the most hospitable people in the world. Any country I went to, like, they had never heard of me, you know, but they knew that I worked for, you know, some huge company. R16 was the name of the competition that I used to work for over in Korea. But people had heard of that. And so I'd go to, you know, Malaysia and I just, you know, in some forum, just be like, hey, any B-boys here? And they're like, yeah, come on. And they would take me around. They'd let me like sleep on their couch. And like, we'd go out to session and like show me the best places to eat. So, I mean, not only did I save a lot of money by like having friends and, you know, B-boy connections in a lot of other places, but I also got to see super cool stuff that aren't, you know, isn't super touristy. And it was pretty dope. If no one has a breakdance friend yet, you better start learning how to dance and go find some if you're going to travel.
It's so funny that you say that because, you know, I housed some German B-boy I'd never met. I met him in Union Square in New York. And it was like that night, hey, you can stay at my place. No worries. Like people, the break scene is so much like that. I don't know what it is. I think you just like, everybody's just really, really nice. I also posted a video in the show notes for R16. If nobody has heard of R16, it's that one like very, well, it's a huge competition, but it featured that one like very, very gif-able moment where a guy's going nuts on a breaking routine. So you've probably seen the routine before at some point on the internet, but R16 is a massive, massive a battle there.
I'm curious about like, do you travel with other digital nomads as well? I know there's a fairly large community of that. So do you seek out other people? Do you meet friends along the way? What does that look like?
That's a good question. So I should say also that there's within doing my digital nomad thing, there's kind of two types of travel for me. There's like travel to live in a place because I don't have a house. And those trips tend to be like 3 months, you know, or maximum holiday visa stay. And I will mostly work on weekdays and then go out and explore on weekends and try and meet and find local people there on different, you know, digital nomad forums or whatnot. But I also have another type of trip that I take. It's like a sub trip within when I'm nomading. And those will typically just be like maybe 3 or 4 days to a more expensive exotic location where I don't want to work. I just want to explore, right? And sometimes I'll go with someone else on those. So one example would be like when I went to Iceland, I went there for a week and I just shut my laptop the whole week. And my dad had never been there and he wanted to go too. So I met him. It was like the first time seeing him in a few years. And we just both toured Iceland together in a car. So it was pretty rad. But yeah, and I'll do, you know, I took a trip to Bali 2 or 3 days with another friend and stuff like that. But usually the shorter trips are with other people.
Oh, yeah.
What is the best place you've been to? Like, where's the coolest, if you have one, even?
So I have to say, this is the question I always get. And it's always the hardest question because it's not based on the place. It's based on the experience. You know, like I've gone to some places. The first time was amazing. And the second time there, it just sucked because you just miss on some experience, you know? Some of the variables that make a place good or bad would be, you know, are you able to make friends there, meet people there and have them show you to like those secret spots, you know? Do you have random things happen to you that are pretty insane? Or are you just going and seeing like tourist spots, you know? So it's different. I will say there are a few countries that stick out, just because I said Mauritius before, there for the beaches, very blue, right? I think some of the nature, Tanzania, like the Serengeti was amazing. Kilimanjaro was amazing, but also Mongolia. One crazy thing about Mongolia is we went out into the country and the roads disappeared. There wasn't even dirt roads anymore. Like our guide was just looking at the compass on his car. And that's how we knew where to go. You know, there's no Google Maps out there. So that was crazy. And then, yeah, some other factors are like food. Like a lot of Southeast Asia, Thailand has like great food. So yeah, there's different factors. There's no one best. It's too hard of a question.
Have you ever gotten really sick eating something in a country?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I could do a whole podcast full of just tips on different countries, like what not to do that I've done. Well, I remember one time, there were a few, but one time was in Cambodia. I went and met up with this group called Tiny Toons, and it's actually like a non-for-profit company, like an NGO out there that helps little kids learn to break dance and go to school. So that was like super cool. But one of the kids, you know, a cute little kid, gave me an icy drink, and I didn't think about it. I just drank it, you know, but that ice that was in it was crushed up from local water, and it just destroyed my stomach. And it's like, yeah, you don't know what to do in those situations as far as going to the doctor and stuff like that. So that was no fun. But most of those, yeah, it's just me not paying attention and not making sure that I'm having bottled water at local countries.
And what about like insurance as well? Like, have you had to go to the doctor abroad, and how do you cover the cost of something like that?
Yeah. So now, as I'm more financially secure and learn more things, I make sure to get travel insurance. When I climbed Kilimanjaro last month, I definitely had that. They even have a special insurance if you're climbing above 6,000 meters that you have to get like extreme insurance. Kilimanjaro is just under 6,000, so I didn't have to pay that extra dollar, which was nice. But yeah, when I first started out, like I literally had no idea what I was doing. I was still using like TurboTax, you know, for my taxes. And I like just everything was all over. So I didn't have any insurance. I didn't even have US insurance. I'm super thankful looking back that like nothing horrible happened, because I would have been in big trouble. I don't recommend not having insurance, but yeah, I didn't have any insurance for 4 years. There was like, you know, times when I got sick, it was usually in countries like, you know, Thailand or something, where it was just really cheap. You know, I got sick, they made me do a little poop test, gave me some medicine, and it was like $10. So I was like, okay, sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. When I got strep throat in Romania when I was there, and I was shocked. The doctor came to my hotel room and like wrote me a script, and it like cost nothing. I was like walked over to the whole experience. I paid in cash. The doctor left. I was like, man, this kind of rules. Like, although I ended up getting strep throat several more times. You can go ahead and listen to some old Syntax episodes to hear about that one. But yeah, wild, man, that's wild. I like think about all of the times that you've made these big choices to go and stay somewhere. Would you consider yourself like a good planner? Is like planning one of your big skills?
I think organization is. And I guess I do have a tendency to overplan a little bit, overthink things. Maybe that helped me a lot. But then at the same time, I do find trips where you plan too much, you don't have as much fun because you don't leave room for spontaneity at all. You know, like those are mostly where you just hit those tourist attractions. You run and see the Eiffel Tower, you know, one day, and then you go and see some bridge and you're like, wow. But the trips where you don't plan is where crazy stuff happens and you're like, I guess I'll just go with it, you know? I definitely have a few stories like that. That like, that's another thing too. The things that are like maybe the worst experiences or the craziest things happening at the time make for the best stories later too. So
yeah, you can always look at it that way. As long as you make it out, survive whatever the situation is.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your mountain climbing expedition, because you just did this a little bit ago, and I was really surprised because I've never known you to necessarily be a mountain climber, but you know, Eric's a really like fit dude. He's always been like very fit. He does a lot of strength based, and he and I went to the Ninja Warrior gym out here in Denver and swung around like monkeys for a bit. But mountain climbing was a new one. Like, what made you want to climb a mountain? One, but like Kilimanjaro's pretty big mountain on another continent. So like the whole business of getting to Kilimanjaro and wanting to, like, what was the inspiration to I want to climb this mountain and this mountain specifically?
Yes, I guess the origin starts actually like where Digital Nomad started for me. If I rewind quite a bit back to when I was a English teacher over in Japan, the whole time, you know, I was being exposed to new cultures and stuff and realizing there's more out there. I want to explore. How can I get out and just see a bunch of countries instead of just, you know, this one at a time? And so around that time, I noticed, Scott, that you were pretty much starting up Level Up Tutorials, and you were telling me that, you know, coding was, you know, pretty dope and I should check it out. So I started to dabble in that. And then I have another friend also named Scott, who owns right now a safari company called Pomoja Safari. But he also was a digital nomad from Michigan. Pretty crazy that I have two Scott, yeah, like computer friends from there. But yeah, so he started talking to me, and I learned about how you could do digital nomading, where he made WordPress sites for clients and stuff. And then he said he just did it from wherever. And so I started taking your WordPress tutorials on YouTube, super dated now, but good content at the time. And they helped. Yeah, it started for about 2 years where I was living in Korea. I just started studying like crazy. And then learning to the point where I could become a digital nomad. But anyways, getting off topic, that friend Scott, who got me started with everything, he later opened a safari company, and they had a tour where you can go on a safari and another one where you can climb Kilimanjaro. And he kept bugging me like, hey, you should come, you know, come do this. And I had to kick it down the road a bit because, you know, I didn't have the finances at the time. And then it got to the point where I did last year, I guess. Yeah. And I was about to pull the trigger, but then because of Corona, it stopped again. And finally got to the point this year, though, where I could do it. And so it gave me a little bit of time to prep, because where I live here in Phoenix, I'm surrounded by mountains. You wouldn't think of it as a mountainous area, but there's a lot of good hiking trails. And so I've just been practicing, bought new boots and wore them in here. And then, yeah, I finally made the leap and hit the mountain.
Wow. So you were, for those of you who don't know, Mount Kilimanjaro is huge. It's the tallest mountain in Africa. So that's not like a day trip or something like that. How long did it take you to get from the start of the hike to the top?
So I want to say from the bottom to the peak, it was 6 days. And then the thing that's funny about the hike is you have to climb really slow to get used to the air level, because the higher you go, the less air there is and you can get altitude sickness. So our pace was so slow that when it was finally time to come back down, we went down the mountain in just 2 days.
Wow. So it's like a sprint down. Do you ever see Reinhold Messner documentary? Have you heard of Reinhold Messner?
I have not.
Okay. So he's like a famous mountain climber from Germany, I believe. And I'll give you something after the show where he was like famous for like skiing down the hardest mountains. He would like climb Everest and then ski down it. Like the dude was bananas. And so that was like his whole thing was like, yeah, you know, you just go up to the top and then on the way down, have some fun. And everybody's like, what is going on with this guy? I'll share with you some documentaries. Anything is well worth watching of anything about him. So you were telling me like mentally the climb was really difficult. And like just yesterday I was at Keystone, which is a ski mountain here in Colorado. And I hiked to the peak from like the top of the chairlift. And that hike was maybe like a 25 minute, 30 minute hike. So it wasn't like super short or anything. But as I was doing that hike, I got up to maybe like 70% of the way through. And I thought about you very specifically. And I thought, man, I cannot believe you climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. Here I'm climbing this like measly little peak here and I'm like barely breathing. So like, how did you mentally persevere through that walk or through that hike, I should say, like knowing that it was so difficult while you were doing it?
Yeah. I mean, what scared me most wasn't my physical ability. It was that altitude sickness is like a crapshoot. They say that some people, doesn't matter how fit you are, you could get affected by it. And then the tour guides will take you down. They'll make you go down, you know? Mm. And I didn't want that to happen to me. And so that was what got me more nervous than anything. But when you're on the mountain and you're actually doing the climb, you're kind of, your back's against the wall, right? Like you have to keep going. You're with a group of people. They're all moving. It's not like you can, in the middle of a workout, like you're benching and you're like, no, I'm lazy today. I think I'll just, you know, do less weight or I'll just stop. It's like you're already halfway up the mountain. It's getting tougher. You have to keep going. You can't just go down and leave everyone else. And they also paid, you know, money to go up there. So I think that was definitely helping me push my boundaries. But also one of the reasons that like I wanted to do Kilimanjaro is obviously because, you know, my friend owns the company and I could trust him and I know I'd have a good experience. But it was that I kind of wanted to push myself outside of my comfort zone, right? Because I'm in the same house every day. Well, when I'm not traveling. You know, coding and like I said, like if I don't want to work out, I don't have to, like, there's always a way to back out of something. Right. And so I wanted to put myself in a situation where mentally I was just kind of at my limits and, I wanted to see what I could do, like where those limits are. it's funny. There was one other guy that he wanted to test his limits even more than me when we were going, this guy Moss, he was wearing barefoot sandals up the whole mountain. And he didn't take any altitude sickness medicine. And he was puking at the very top. He was the only one that didn't take the medicine and the only one puking. And so I'm sure he found his limits there. But yeah, it's pretty crazy. And I think mixed with the fact that the top of the mountain, it's about 50% oxygen, right? So every single thing you do up there is like, it just makes you incredibly out of breath. I remember there was a helicopter pad like 3/4 of the way up and I was like, ooh, I want to, you know, do a quick little session for the gram. And yeah. I did like, you know, like a small little six step with heavy boots on. And like, I was dying right afterwards. I was like trying so hard to catch my breath. But then, you know, it gets amplified though, the higher you get, because so I should talk about the summit part, right? Like this is the craziest part. You finally get to summit day. That's what you get nervous for the whole hike. There's no technical climbs, the whole thing, no hands. It's mostly just, you know, trails that go upward. But the whole time they keep telling you summit's the hardest, summit's the hardest. And so for those first 5 days, you just get nervous about that. But summit day looked like this, right? It starts off with 3-hour hike to base camp in the morning. And then you try and sleep during the day. And then you take off to the summit at midnight. And it's about 7 or 8 hours to the very top of the summit. So we've started our hike at midnight, right? Which means it's the coldest time of the day because there's no sun. And all of a sudden, I wake up to thunder and lightning and a snowstorm. And they're like, this never happens. I'm like, of course. You know, but so, yeah, like this, it starts going crazy with weather. But again, we have to go. And so there's this word that they use over there in Swahili, pole pole, which means slowly. And they just ingrain that into your head because you go too fast, you get a headache, you run out of breath, whatever. But that summit part, when you're going up, like you have to take that to the extreme. One of the guides is a pace setter, right? So he just goes, walk, 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 like really slow. That's the pace you're going at. And you follow him. And like, even at that pace, you get out of breath, like little things that you wouldn't think of make you out of breath.
Wow.
So for me, I had a camelback, like a little straw for my water. And if I wanted to just get a sip of water on my way up, I have to take off my mitten. I have to grab the water and then find a way to put the mitten back on, which seems, you know, easy enough. But just that was getting me out of breath. And the guides would like have to help me put my glove back on. One guide had to help me tie my shoe. I felt like a toddler trying to, you know, do anything up there. And like your brain isn't like fully aware of anything. You're kind of euphoric because there isn't as much oxygen.
Yeah.
Like when the sun first started to peak, I slowly got to see it like over my shoulder and everything looked like CGI, seeing a sunrise over clouds instead of over the horizon, you know? And like, yeah. I was like, am I walking into heaven right now? It was pretty crazy. Like I almost came to terms at that moment. I was like, you know, I think it's okay if I die right now. Not that I was trying to, but like, because, you know, at least people say, oh, he died on Kilimanjaro. And like, I felt a bit, you know, euphoric because of the lack of oxygen, but that was the toughest part. And then, yeah, so once you hit the top 8 hours later and you celebrate, you're like, oh, I have to come back down now. It's like 8 hours to go back down. And like after you finally made it to the bottom 2 days later, what was crazy is that you would not expect this, Scott, but I was like, oh, of course. When I finally reached the bottom, there was a guy practicing breakdancing at the bottom of the mountain.
No way.
I kid you not. I'm serious. And his like little sister was recording him. And then everyone in my group was like, dude, you know what you have to do. And I was like, but I just climbed Kilimanjaro. I was like, okay. So I went over and I challenged the guy to like two or three rounds and I ciphered with him real quick.
Oh my gosh.
Like, it was like the perfect ending, you know, to that mountain. But it was crazy. It was a crazy adventure.
Man, that's awesome. That's so cool. Those types of things. It's like, I don't know. I've watched a lot of mountaineering documentaries. It's the type of thing I would really love to try. I just don't know if I'm ever going to get there in life, and to live vicariously through you in this has been pretty amazing.
You have some good mountains over in Colorado. So, you know, there's some 1,400 feeders over there. So
I should start some 14ers. We were going to do it right before we had kids, and then we missed our, like, the September is the time when it's like really good to do 14ers. And we missed the one right before we had kids, and I think that was it, man. Until for a little bit, because they all require at least a little bit of camping or a little bit of pre-planning in that regard. So maybe some point here.
Yeah, I'm curious about like what you travel with to actually do web dev, and this is sort of parlaying into our supper club questions. But I think we talk about it a little bit longer. Like, what are you packing? Like in terms of computer, mouse, or something like that?
Yeah. So again, it depends on trips. If it's like a sub trip or like a full on nomad trip. Right now, the trips I take are usually anywhere between a month and 2 weeks or so. And I've got it down to an art where I can fit everything in one backpack. Actually, last week, I just got back from, I went to Florida for a week and Michigan for a week. And I think this is a good example of one of my mini trips. So didn't pay for a carry-on, didn't pay for a check-in. I just had my personal item, which was a small Osprey 33-talon backpack. And because I have, you know, my company and then another company, I packed two laptops, okay? And then which is like the heaviest part of it. It's pretty insane. But I had to. But then I use packing cubes that I got from REI. And I just roll up my clothes and I fit everything for the 2 weeks in there. Now, the big thing that makes clothes go a long way is, it sounds weird, but all my underwear and socks are wool. They're merino wool. And what I do is I bring like a shampoo for wool. And yeah. I get more uses out of them that way than cotton. And I just wash them in the sink. And so that little bit of shampoo, it counts as, you know, it's small enough that I can use it as a liquid that I bring in and not have to worry about checking in a bag.
So, man, packing cubes are really like a sick pick. I mean, I love packing cubes. I'm happy to hear that they're a part of your setup.
Yeah, it just makes things easy to organize, get in and out of, especially when you're camping too.
That's great. The wool thing, my wife would love to hear that. My wife is all about getting the right material for the situation you're in. And it's funny, when we go on trips and everything, she's bringing those tiny little detergents that you can do in the sink and whatnot. I love that.
I was just going to say, everyone thinks wool is going to be hot, but I have wool t-shirts too, and I wear them in summer in Arizona. So
wow. I've never tried a wool t-shirt. I'm a big fan of the wool socks all winter, but never tried a wool t-shirt. I think I'm going to try that. Is there a specific brand that you wear or just?
Yeah. So my favorite is pretty expensive. It's called Outlier. It's from New York, but I also wear Unbound is pretty good too. And then if you get into the more sporty stuff, there's like Icebreaker, but yeah, those are some of my top brands for wools.
I suppose if you're only buying a couple of them, you don't doesn't matter if it's that expensive, right? Because you can't even pack that many. And you were just telling me the other day you were thinking about buying a MacBook Air, and hearing that you had to carry two laptops for your last trip seems like that might actually be the right call there.
Right. And what about, do you take like a mouse with you? Have you ever looked into those like portable external monitors? Do you use an iPad, or is it just MacBook? That's it.
Yeah. So if we think about my normal setup at a cafe, I always bring my mouse and mouse pad because the trackpad just doesn't do it for me. I just can't code and get around with it. I usually bring an external keyboard too, like one of the smaller Mac ones. And then if possible, I'll get a stand for the laptop so that I'm not crouched over. It's just kind of standing up straight in front of me. But one other thing that I tend to do a lot is I have these cool little clips that you can put on the side of your monitor for your laptop. And I have an iPad Pro, like the 12.19 inch one, and I clip it to the side and I use it as an external monitor. So like I could be at a cafe in a small, on a small table and just have that extra monitor hanging off the side. And so I can fit everything on one desk. People look at me like I'm crazy if I'm in a cafe working like that, but hey, you're never going to see them again, right?
Yeah. You're lugging around an iMac or something. I've seen that before.
And then one other thing that I always travel with when I do the long-term ones, when I'm traveling out of a suitcase, is gymnastic rings. I bring those everywhere because I get the best workout out of those, like the bang for your buck. You don't have to worry about weights really because you can do pull-ups and then, you know, push-ups on them. And then I bring a foam roller that's hollow, and it has two purposes for me. One, it's a foam roller so I can, you know, use it for recovery and stuff. But because it's kind of like got a hollowed out inner core and a mini one, I should say, not like a full on body size one, but because it has a hollow core, I put my fragile stuff inside it. Like if I'm buying alcohol for someone, like a wine bottle, put it in there and I don't have to worry about it breaking. So everything has, if you can find a dual purpose for something, you need to do that. That's definitely necessary. Dual purpose is key though, with clothing also. So I don't know if Scott remembers, I used to be big on shoes. I had like 40 pairs, but when you get down to one suitcase, you know, everything has to have a purpose. So I had a reversible belt, one side's black, one side's brown. Most of my shirts become monotone so that I can, you know, mix and match pretty easily. Same with the pants. So I guess my style became pretty boring when I became a digital nomad, but I don't have to worry about having, you know, everything match each other. I can just throw on something and know that it'll match.
And what about like a battery bank? Do you travel with that and a hotspot? In Canada, a long time ago, I had this like a little hotspot that I would, it was like a orange puck. I forget the name of it. Basically, it was a hotspot you could bring anywhere in the world. And it wasn't amazing, but it was better than the data roaming that you could get with your thing. I don't use that anymore because there's better data roaming with my thing, with my phone carrier. But I'm curious if you bring a battery or a hotspot around.
So I use, my phone carrier is Google Fi. And back in the day when I was, you know, 4 years straight country to country, I would just use Google Fi and it worked in most countries except for some places, which are probably covered now. The problem doing full-time digital nomading now with that service is, though, I've heard that they start to cut people off if you're out of the country longer than 3 months. So, because it racks up roaming costs, I think it like leeches onto the nearest signal. And so for me now, it still works because I only, you know, I always come back to my home base in Phoenix and then I'll go out for like a month or two. But I don't know if I can recommend that for full-time digital nomads right now. And battery bank, never really needed. There's always, you know, a place to plug in your laptop usually.
Interesting.
Yeah.
For anyone listening, at least in Canada, during the pandemic, when I was up at our cottage before we had Starlink, I went deep into the like global roaming US SIM card and I did really good. The AT&T one, they say we have the right to cut you off, but I was doing terabytes on a $50 SIM card and it never once slowed down.
Terabytes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. What about shoes? What kind of shoes you do now? You said you, you know, you slim down. Is there like a travel shoe? Is there like a, do you prioritize comfort?
Yes. Having a home base now, I have a lot of shoes for different things. I have trail running shoes, you know, bouldering, rock climbing shoes, and, you know, jogging, et cetera. But when traveling, Kilimanjaro was one where I brought these things called Skinners, and they look like socks, but they have like this rubbery grip at the bottom. And they're basically, yeah, they're just like barefoot shoe socks or whatever. But when, after a day of climbing, when you're at base camp, you just walk around, and I would just wear those. And a lot of times working out too, I do a lot of combat sports, like, you know, boxing and whatnot. And I'll just wear those too. Same with, you know, weightlifting. I'm on this barefoot shoe trip now, but they roll up nicely. They can be washed, but usually I just, yeah, one pair of black or white sneakers is what I would travel with. Maybe one pair of dress shoes. And as I said, though, one pair in, one pair out, right? When you're traveling with a big suitcase, because you only have space for so much. Those used to usually take up the most space.
I'm going to get some of these Skinners. This will look right at my alley. And I need like grippy socks. And these are like a hybrid grippy sock, because I keep falling down and getting hurt.
Yeah. I also want to buy a pair of shoes called, like, there's Zero is the brand, X-E-R-O. I haven't tried them yet, but I've been recommended. Those are good barefoot shoes. And then when I'm breaking, Scott, you know, Dizzy, he has his own line of shoes, Dizzy Threads. He gave me a pair of those. Yeah. So I break in those too. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh man. How are they? I don't think Dizzy's going to be listening to this, but
so. No, they're dope. I mean, they're shoes that I got for free, and I need something to break in. I don't break as much as I used to, but you can slide on them nice. There's felt. So yeah.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, one thing I will say, Americans have it good, because the credit card points, like the system over here for getting plane tickets, is amazing. I have, you know, a few credit cards that I do like credit card churning with. I've racked up some points, and my whole flight to Kilimanjaro was paid for with credit card, you know. So that's definitely one thing to look at. There's other crazy deals. So I actually just got a couple weeks ago the best deal of my life, from this Facebook group I followed called, I want to say, Secret Flyer. They're telling me about something called like this fuel dump thing. And I'm not going to pretend like I understand the details. I just look at the price, right? But basically there's like some flight you can take that has to, I don't know if it's legally or whatever, dump fuel, and it makes the fuel price zero, right? So if you link that with another big trip, then you can get zero off the fuel price of the whole trip. So in April, I have a trip coming up where I go from LA to Osaka for 3 weeks round trip, and it cost me $250.
What?
Wow. Oh yeah. My God.
Holy smokes. And are you booking these just on like the big airline websites, or is there a special website that has it? Like, I know you found it on the Facebook group, but that is, you just booked that through the regular booking?
That was booked with Expedia.
Yeah. Okay.
But wow. Most of my searching I do with Google. They have a great search feature where if you don't know where you want to go, you just check Explore, and it shows you a map within the next 6 months. And then you just kind of look around the globe for the cheapest price based on where you're at. So that's what I used to do all the time, is like, I was in, you know, Singapore, and I was like, where can I go? Oh, Australia is only $400 one way. I'll go there. Then I'm in Australia and I need a ticket to the next country, or I get in trouble with my visa. I'm like, oh, you know, Vietnam's only like $300 from here. But you have to be flexible on times and dates if you do those, because if you only have a set holiday period for your job, like, you're just not going to be able to get the best price. You just have to get weird flights with like day layovers in places.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I never knew about this Explorer. So to get here, folks, if you want to check this out, you go to google.com. You click the more buttons and then flights. And then that takes you to like their Google flight search. But then there's a small link that says explore destinations, and it'll take your current location and then price out everywhere. I've never seen this. And I'm going to send this to Courtney because she's going to go nuts for this. I'll tell you that right now.
And flight prices too, they're like stocks, right? They go up and down every day. So if you find a flight you like with that feature, and then you can click track and you can track it, you get notifications in the email of it going up or down, and it'll tell you if it's a good or bad price really. So sometimes I'll watch certain flights, you know, a bunch of different ones. And if something good comes up, I'll just jump on it. It's usually what I do. 6 weeks out or 6 months out usually tend to be the two cheapest times that I find, but it's a crapshoot.
Wow, this is cool. I did not know this existed.
Do you ever have issues with the like border guards being like, what are you coming here for? And you're like, I'm just chilling. Or like, do you have to dance around the fact that you are working remotely? Because that's always something, is like, you're working here, kind of like you're just going on your computer, but you still are working, right?
Yeah. So that is a good question. You know, sometimes I remember going into Korea once, not when I lived there, but just on, you know, the digital nomad thing. And they're like, how long are you staying here? You know, going through the questions. And I was like, 3 months. And the one girl's like, 3 months? What are you doing? I'm like, I was just visiting friends. I don't know, just chilling, you know? I think they're used to some people that just like, I don't know, spoiled rich kids that have no budget and just want to travel. So if I tell them I own a company, you know, even though in reality, it's just, you know, kind of like a proxy for some contract work for insurance purposes. But if you tell them you own a company, they're like, oh, he has enough money to stay here for 3 months, you know, whatever. So it's not too bad. You just never tell them that you're working there. Like, never say I came here to work or I'm going to be working from cafes, you know, just say you're taking a break.
I don't know if you guys have the show Border Security over there, but that's one of my favorite shows. Have you seen that?
No, I've never heard of that. Oh, that sounds very Canadian.
In Canada and in Australia, we have, it's basically, it's just, they put cameras in the airport and people are like coming through with a butchered goat, and they're like, you're not allowed to bring a butchered goat on your carry-on, or like how much money do you have? Several hundred dollars. And they open their bag up and it's just like $60,000 in cash just lined up. They're like, I forgot about that. It's hilarious. And it makes me a little bit stressed out, because crossing the border is always a little bit of a sweaty palms thing, but it's a good show to watch.
Depends on the country.
Did y'all ever see this last year, or no, 2021 came up. Here's a big story. TSA posts video of raw chicken on baggage carousel to reminders to passengers how to properly pack raw meat. And it was like a huge thing full of raw chicken in the baggage carrier. I remember when this story came up, I was just like thinking, yeah, who thought that was a great idea to try to bring in raw chicken?
I've seen a person pack a full bag of kimchi as their check-in. That smelled horrible.
Oh, yeah. I would do that. I'm all over that. That's great.
You travel enough and you always come across some crazy stories. So I'll just share like one that sticks out in particular that was kind of funny. It was out in Mongolia. So I went on a tour where we would just go out into the middle of the country and we'd stay in like yurts and stuff. It was great, right? So the weirdest thing happened to me, and I don't know if it was like some sort of sign that I just didn't read or whatever, but I was with two other people, like this couple, and we found like a river and we wanted to go swim in it. Oh, this is summer, not winter, definitely. But when we got to the river, there is this like naked dude just swimming in the river, naked bald dude, right? And we didn't think anything of it at first, but then he like comes up to me. He puts a towel on, luckily. But he doesn't speak any English, and I don't speak Mongolian. And he's showing me like this piece of paper that's like inside a bell. And he's like, help me, kind of, you know? And so I help him pull this piece of paper out of a bell, and he starts ringing the bell. And he's like, you know, kind of like, thank you, you got it working. And I was like, dude, I don't know what that was about, whatever. But then, and this is such a random story, right? But all of a sudden this guy starts like hobbling over on one leg, another guy, and just comes up to us. And this is a little bit later, and like we had just finished swimming, and now the naked monk, he's kind of over to the side drying off. But this guy on one leg and crutches comes and pulls a knife on us, right? And
oh my God.
I'm just kind of like, what the heck is this? What do I do? Do I slowly walk away because he only has one leg? Or like, you know, how do I get away from this? But all of a sudden, I guess like this naked monk sees us and runs over and he starts, and I'm not going to translate Mongolian, but I'm translating gestures, right? But he basically says to the guy like, no, these are my friends. They helped me pull, like save my bell or whatever. And got
pull a piece of paper out of your bell.
Yeah. And so this guy, he puts down his knife. He like looks at us and then he offers us some vodka out of like a half like cut up, I don't know, like pop can or whatever, soda can. And I didn't want to get tetanus. So I was like, no, thanks. And then he tried to sell us like a box of mints. And like, he suddenly became our friend too. And I was like, I don't know what just happened. Again, maybe there's some spiritual significance behind this. But
cosmic dominoes.
Yeah, I don't know. But that was my fun little Mongolia story from when I was there.
Oh, that's wild.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, that's good.
So, Eric, did you bring a sick pick for us today? I know there's been a lot of sick picks in this episode.
Yeah, I kind of said a lot of stuff, right?
Like, yeah.
I guess those Skinners are my sick pick. I love, yeah, those shoes. They roll up easy. I can put them in my pocket. I do all my workouts in them, even some, you know, trail running. So, Skinners it is.
Yeah, I'll post it. I'm going to buy some of these.
By the way, on one of the last episodes, I was talking about how black socks are the most weird thing ever. And we ran a poll on Syntax and I got destroyed by that. It seems that most people enjoy black socks over white.
I got like multi-colored gray.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
See?
Yeah. Sorry.
I can't believe I'm in the minority. Like almost everybody I know wears white socks.
Yeah. Well, maybe you got to change who you're hanging out with.
I think so. It says,
get some cool friends.
Speaks volumes. Yeah.
Well, okay. What about shameless plugs? Is there anything you would like to plug?
Yeah. So I guess I can plug my company, Pure Funk. That's P-U-R-E. How do you spell funk again? Oh yeah. F-U-N-C, not K. .io is a website. And Pomoja's Safari, just because, you know, I went to Kilimanjaro with them. Had a great experience.
How do you say that?
And, of course, Level Up Tutorials. Pomoja. P-A-M-O-J-A-S. Safaris, yeah. And they have Instagram cool. Make sure we as well.
Sick.
I got to plug Level Up Tuts because, yeah, I contribute to the code there. Even though it doesn't need plugging.
Yeah, no, it's all good. We appreciate it. Thanks so much for coming on, man. This has been something I've been wanting to do for a long time. And, you know, you're endlessly inspiring in the stuff that you're doing. So I hope everybody was, you know, really entertained. There's so much cool stuff here. And thanks for coming on, Eric.
Oh, and if people want to see some of the stuff I was talking about, my Instagram is The Epic Life. And I have some of those pictures on there. And then I have a travel blog that's kind of outdated, but it's at my main website, ericsartorius.com.
Sick. I'll make sure I get all that linked up as well.
Just followed. Sick. All right. Thanks so much for coming on. Really appreciate all your time.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. It was great to be here, guys.
Peace.
Peace. Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.